Welcome to SMT Pod, the premier audio publication for the Society for Music Theory. In this week's episode, Lydia Bangura analyzes her own performance choices in comparison to a professional recording using Jennifer Roniak's framework of co-performance.
Playing Dress Up, co-performance with Mozart's Abendzeitfindung, K523. Often, I struggle to explain why my favorite recordings of a given song resonate so strongly with me. Sometimes it seems random why I prefer one over another. Perhaps a recorded performance just catches me in the right place at the right time? Musicologist Jennifer Roniak shares this experience, as she was so captivated by the performances and recordings of baritone Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau that they in part inspired her to study the German language. In her article, Meeting Bartz at Fischer-Dieskau's Mill, Co-Performance, Linguistic Identity, and a Lied, Roniak describes the sense of loss that she experienced at the death of the German baritone. Roniak explores the idea of co-performance with recordings by noting that her relationship to Schubert's music, embodied in Fischer-Dieskau's performances, makes the score indistinguishable from the recordings. To her, the recordings have become equivalent to the songs themselves. In this podcast episode, I will demonstrate my own use of co-performance by comparing soprano Barbara Bonney's recording of Abendzeitfindung K523 by Mozart to my own recording, investigating the tone colors that Bonney employs and how my voice is informed by this recording. Combined with my theoretical and contextual understanding of the piece, I use both music analytical and performance analytical frameworks to inform performance decisions. Roniak articulates the exact relationship I have with my favorite recordings. Whether a popular song, a cinematic orchestral soundtrack, or an art song. When I am tasked with the challenge of learning a new art song or aria for the first time, I embark on my YouTube pilgrimage to find treasure recordings to cling to during the rehearsal process. I have never paused to ponder the effects of this ritual on my perceptions of song, my rehearsal process, or ultimately my performances of vocal music. The framework of co-performance allows me to analyze my own performance choices in relation to a recorded performance, noting how that performance influences my interpretation of the music. Roniak distinguishes performance from co-performance. For her, co-performance is inherently corporeal on the part of the listener because it involves feeling or imagining what it would be like to sing or play like the recorded artist. It therefore connects the bodies of the performers and listeners and requires a special kind of active listener participation. In co-performance, the co-performers are the listener, the composer, the score, and the recorded performer. Historically, it has been common practice to reduce both the performer and the recording to secondary status, in favor of uplifting the composer and the score. In Roniak's interpretation, however, the performer and the recording are more than simply the vessel for the composer. They are an integral part of the music making themselves. As Daniel Borowski writes, quote, "Performers are analysts and historians of a different kind," end quote. A performance itself is an account of the performer's understanding of historical performance practices, language, and musical details. It is not only the dialogue between music academics, but the conversation between performers that deserves consideration. Similarly, Arne Cox describes embodied music making through mimesis, writing, quote, "When we take an aesthetic interest in something, whether people watching or attending a sporting event or a film or a concert, our responses can be understood as if we are implicitly asking, what's it like to do that? Along with the corollary question, what's it like to be that? In effect, it is if we are responding to an invitation to somehow imitate and thus take part," end quote. The impulse to take part is co-performance, whether it's an attempted imitation or the urge to expand upon a performance. Daphne Long observes how the combined study of performance and analysis can display multiple ways of knowing. In the German language, this is demonstrated by three separate words to describe knowing. Quote, wissen, or knowing that, können, knowing how, and kennen, knowing as in knowing a person, end quote. Co-performance allows for these varied ways of knowing and accounts for feeling familiar with music through a performance. These all empower the listener with a well-rounded understanding of how they might approach their own performance. Another aspect of co-performance is what Roniak refers to as linguistic materiality, by which she means the, quote, corporeal sources, perception, and effects of spoken or sung language taken together, end quote. Singers have the unique musical challenge of mastering the materiality of foreign languages and must expertly differentiate between the feeling of different languages in the mouth. We must hypothesize through co-performance what it is like to sing in our language of choice. We constantly try on different lip and tongue positions. We experiment with foreign vowel sounds and consonant combinations. And we battle with text stress and syllable emphasis. Singers inevitably bring a bit of their native tongue to any foreign language they pursue, coloring the listener's experience of their linguistic performance. Singing in foreign languages requires singers to be theorists of music, language, and poetry all at once. For the purposes of this podcast, my implementation of co-performance acknowledges my simultaneous roles as a constant audience member for these recordings and as a performer. These professional recordings help me become a professional myself as I mimic them, attempt their maturity, and clumsily experiment with their linguistic prowess, while still maintaining my own sense of originality. Music theory often involves looking at the score as a fixed art object. For me, co-performance values both the score and the recording as fixed archival objects, in concurrence and in relation to each other, in order to develop one's own performance choices. In the next section, I consider how a singer might co-perform with Mozart and the score to Abendempfindung, before evaluating my own co-performance with Barbara Bonney's recording of this lied. Mozart's collection of Lieder, while not particularly extensive, is representative of German song in the 18th century. Melancholy and sentimental, sometimes with themes of death and the exploration of the afterlife. Several of Mozart's songs set texts that explore these themes, including An die Hoffnung, An die Einsamkeit, and Abendempfindung. Weighty and rolling, Abendempfindung shows Mozart's skillful ability to interpret text and music in profound ways. This song offers many opportunities for singers to show off with long phrases, dramatic key changes, dynamic text, and formal ambiguities. Mozart's harmonic journey in Abendempfindung begins in F major, and he explores that key and its relation to other keys in an ambiguous three-part form that invites the singer to consider several performance possibilities. By far the longest section of the piece is the B section. By devoting the most time and harmonic complexity to the B section, Mozart unconventionally stretches the form and fully explores the inner stanzas of the text. The harmony blossoms during this section, where the key changes at least every phrase. The elaborate harmonic voyage paired with the dense poetry makes for a dramatic result, not unlike an opera aria. At first, I gravitated towards this piece because of the pronounced harmonic pivots. It was one of the first pieces that made me feel like an opera singer, even though it's an art song. My musical instincts directed me to accent every cadence and emphasize moments of chromaticism in the melodic line. The piece, especially when considering the sentimental text, also has delicate moments of harmonic stability. The poet, Joachim Heinrich Campe, wanders through complex musings of reckoning with one's own mortality. Of course, this all makes the song quite challenging to perform. With the average performance time of the song running just under 5 minutes, it requires an advanced level of stamina, breathwork, and understanding of the momentum of the poetry and vocal line from the singer. The grand and rolling nature of the vocal line suggests that this is a lead for a more mature singer. As I attempted to learn the song with my developing voice, I sang alongside Barbara Bonney's recording of Abendempfindung. Embodied in this performance is everything I wanted my own performance to be. She sings with bright, pleasing vowels, incredible breath support and stamina, prolonged consonants, and the perfect amount of drama. This performance had a huge impact on my conceptualization of the song and continues to affect not only how I perform it, but also how I imagine my own voice. I turn now to this professional recording of Abendempfindung to evaluate Bonney's performance interpretations, consider our similarities and differences, and examine her use and familiarity with the German language. I note my favorite moments in her performance as I tried to imitate them in my own recording. American soprano Barbara Bonney brings a bright and clear sound to all of the music that she performs. Both an operatic and concert soprano, Bonney is well known for her recordings of Lieder. Her interpretation of Abendempfindung with pianist Jeffrey Parsons features forward vowel placement, predominant rolled R's, and delicate dynamics. Because German vowels tend to be darker than other languages, such as Italian or English, they can lose resonance when sitting further back in the mouth and throat. But Bonney's pronunciation places the vowels in the mask area of the face, vibrantly sending the sounds forward to the listener. This can be heard especially when she sings the word Sonne, the word Tanz, and even with the umlaut sound on the word Schönste. Her focus on these vowel sounds also assists her legato. Each word is seamlessly connected to the last, despite the constant consonant clusters. I have accomplished this in my own performance, but only sparingly, as this forward placement is quite difficult to develop. Once the melody drops below an A4, bringing vowels forward in the mouth becomes increasingly difficult for me as the melody descends. Therefore, I revere Bonney's pronunciation of the word Tanz, sung on an E4. Tanz. Bonnie shows flexibility in terms of tempo, accelerating and slowing down, especially in the first and last sections of the piece. Her pace feels natural and conversational, and the German consonants sound at home in her mouth. I have often been instructed to keep the tempo at the same pace in order to correctly articulate the German text. Bonnie's quickened tempo signals an ease and familiarity with the text that I do not yet have. In contrast, Bonnie ends the piece with a series of ritardandos throughout the last section. In order to stretch the already long phrases, this musical choice requires incredible stamina. Slowing down towards the end of the piece has the potential to make it feel heavy, like it is dragging towards the finish. When I attempt to slow down these final phrases, my struggle to finish each phrase is audible, and causes the end of the piece to feel fraught with tension. However, when Bonnie adds this tempo flexibility, it is both sensational and sophisticated, adding a sense of finality to the song. Through these tempo choices, her agency as a singer is asserted and portrays to me, as a listener, a sense of confidence that I long to have myself. I also admire Bonnie's consonant pronunciation. One of my favorite instances is on the word rot. This melodic gesture of falling by a fifth signals the transition into the B section of the piece. Bonnie takes her time pronouncing the rolled R, drawing it out for almost a full second. This is followed by a second and shorter rolled R on the word herab. I too aim to make this moment quite pronounced, as I understand the harmony to be making an important shift. However, I am limited in my performance capacity because I am only able to flip my R's. I know, an opera singer who can't roll her R's? Yes, it is embarrassing, but rest assured, I'm working on it. I've yet to successfully roll my R's, and therefore can only imagine what this feels like in the mouth and on the tongue. I am also limited by my understanding of the linguistic materiality of German. I have a basic grasp of vocabulary, but a fledgling understanding of how German is supposed to feel in the mouth and throat when sung or spoken. Here, I am co-performing false linguistic fluency that doesn't account for my own native linguistic identity. Sometimes I gravitate towards emphasizing a German word just because of the way it feels to sing, even if that word isn't significant within the context of the phrase or the stanza. It is unique to my American ears and mouth, and therefore exciting. I will prolong the experience of singing it, simply because it feels good. Towards the end of the B section, for example, the vocal line moves upward in a dramatic key change. A singer can project the excitement of the moment through the umlauted U vowel, but that vowel sound belongs to the demanding word pflückte. The singer must pronounce all three beginning consonant sounds, P, F, and L, in rapid succession, a remarkable expedition through different mouth positions in order to produce the necessary sounds. P, F, pflückte. This consonant combination is uncommon in English and exhilarating for me as a non-native German speaker to sing. This word is a point in the piece where I deviate from Bonnie, who performs this moment with little fanfare. She pronounces pflückte so delicately that the consonants are barely heard, whereas I attempt a dramatic pronunciation. Our differing interpretations could certainly be because of the clunkiness of the German language in my own mouth, but I also attribute it to one of the only moments in the piece where the piano and the voice have synced rhythms. I want to call attention to this moment through prolonged pronunciation. There are many more musical choices that I wish to pursue that I do not yet have access to as a young singer. So I hold this recording close, hoping that one day I may actualize my ideal performance decisions. Roniak's idea of co-performance encapsulates my own relationship to certain recordings. Both my theoretical analysis and my obsession with this recording solidify my own performance choices. But the analysis of co-performance bears questioning. Do I sound like me? Or do I sound like a mishmash of my favorite recordings? What is the difference? What does it mean to sound like me when my instinct is first to consult professional recordings? Where did my impulse to consult professional recordings at the start of my rehearsal process even come from? Ultimately, I am limited in my musical expressions and performance choices, not only because of my current abilities as a singer, for example, not being able to roll my R's, but also because of my limited agency as a younger performer. Due to a combination of historical performance practices and my teacher's preferences, I'm frequently blocked from listening to my own musical impulses. I am referring now to stylistic choices, not choices relating to technique. The feedback from my teachers is the same, that I am to perform said piece like a given recording. I wonder, at what point in my career do I have the agency to make my own musical choices, separate from the interpretations of my predecessors? The combination of my current vocal abilities and lack of artistic authority can feel stifling. Classical singers' voices normally fully mature between the ages of 30 and 35, when they will more or less solidify into the voice they'll have for the rest of their performance career. The voice still changes throughout its lifetime as the body ages, but the changes are minute compared to the changes in one's voice that happen throughout one's 20s. Therefore, I latch on to recordings due to a lack of my own vocal identity. I don't know what my mature voice will sound like, and neither do my teachers. How do you train a hypothetical voice, a voice that doesn't exist yet? A teacher may shepherd it by having it imitate something that is tangible, like a recording. After all, one cannot give a developing voice too much freedom. So it is tempting to suppress one's own voice in favor of simply imitating. It keeps the young performer's focus towards their professional future self. However, instead of fixating on someday, what do I do with the voice I have now? Co-performance offers young performers like me the chance to witness what is possible and allows them to dream up performance choices beyond their current inhibitions. I'd like to thank David Kerr, Mark Hannaford, Kim Lawford, and John Peterson for their feedback on earlier drafts of this research. I'd also like to thank my peer reviewers, Sherston Johnson and Daniel Barolski, for their valuable feedback. Finally, my thanks to Megan Lyons, Zach Lloyd, and the rest of the SMT Pod team for their help with producing this episode.
Visit our website, smt-pod.org, for supplemental materials related to this episode and to learn how to submit an episode proposal. And join in the conversation by tweeting us your questions and comments at smt_pod. SMT Pod's theme music was written by Maria Tartaglia, with closing music by Ika Zheng.